Hey, Rich, pop quiz.
Ooh, I like pop quizzes. Hit me.
I know you do. Okay. What do Titanic, Celine Dion, and Steven Spielberg have in common?
Now, that does sound like a plot to a Hollywood movie.
Close. The answer is Paul Farberman, music lawyer, industry legend, and the calm in the chaos behind some of the biggest moments in pop culture.
Yes, and you know, he's like the guy you didn't know you knew. From CBS Records, that little song, My Heart Will Go On, to producing Broadway shows, the man has done it all. So many stories!
Like how that Titanic song, you know.
The little baby one.
The small film.
You know, that little thing.
Yeah. How that song almost didn't happen.
Crazy, huh? Oh. So crazy. I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. And you know, this episode is part music history. It's part masterclass in trust, timing, and just showing up for people.
And also, he somehow made time for a music festival and clocked in over 22,000 steps. I mean, who does that?
Clearly someone who loves music festivals. Yeah. Well, listen, legend status confirmed.
Check.
Let's jump in.
Let's jump in.
Let's do it.
Paul, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be
lovely
here.
Lovely to have you here.
Thank you.
At Vitello's.
The lovely Vitello's.
And Studio City.
The lovely Studio City.
Absolutely.
California.
The very hot Studio City.
Exactly. In the Velvet Martini Lounge, right? That's what we're
calling. This is a Martini Lounge. No martinis.
Too early for martinis.
We're doing martinis right now.
I wouldn't be drinking one anyway, but it is early for a martini.
What's your drink of choice?
Water.
Okay.
Water.
Yeah.
You said it very quickly.
Because I've never had a drink of alcohol in my life. Well, I mean, I tasted.
Yes.
But I, as a young boy, I grew up loving the worst soda pop drinks, Orange Crush and Grape Crush, and creams, which are sugar and sweet.
Oh.
So when you're used to drinking that, when I first tasted wine or beer, it was just such a foreign, horrible taste to me. And I never grew up enough to acquire a taste for wine or champagne, let alone horrible alcohol and beer. So I've never been drunk.
Oh, Pop, but those sugar highs are like...
I never
drunk.
Have an excuse for my actions. I can't say, oh my God, I was so drunk last night, I'm so sorry.
You don't have an out. You didn't discover an out. Oh.
So, yeah.
Well, I can't say that.
Neither can I. I can't either.
Thank you for joining us today. It's an absolute pleasure having you here. Honored to have someone who's been in the industry, the music industry, for as long as you have, with as much legacy as you have, and the people you've worked with, the projects you've worked on. How did you get into it? How did you start?
So growing up in Toronto, I loved music. I played drums. I think I had my first little toy drum set up when I was like 5 or 6 years old. And then when I was 13, I actually got a real drum set, and I had it for about a day.
One day
because I went with my dad to buy it. We brought it home, put it in my bedroom, and my mom came home and said, "Reuben, what are you doing?"
Oh, no.
And you can't have that in the house. And I cried, and we took them back to the store.
Oh, Paul.
Because she wasn't prepared for it.
Okay.
So she calmed down, and eventually I did get another set of drums. And when I was 13, it was the Beatles, invasion and all. The British invasion and all that. So I played drums, and I just grew up loving music. When I went to college, I didn't, like a lot of young people, I didn't have any real goals in mind. I didn't really know what I wanted to be. I went through and just took whatever courses I thought would get me the best grades and finished college. And then what do? I didn't know what to do, but come from a nice Jewish family. What do I become? a lawyer or a doctor? So I went to law school. As a lot of my friends did, not because of any great passion to be a lawyer, but even while I was in law school at the college, I took a performance workshop where I played jazz and drums, not for credit, but just, I was lucky when I graduated. Not at first, but I graduated from law school, and like now and even back then, it's difficult to find jobs coming out of law school.
Right.
And there was a job on the bulletin board of school about some lawyer who needed just this one guy up there, sort of a east end of town. In Toronto.
Okay.
And my parents said, well, you should go for the job. So the guy hired me, and I didn't want to do it. My parents said, well, look, you'll make some money, you'll get some experience.
Right.
And then a month later, walk in to the office. It was just a two-man office out in the sort of suburbs. There's a note, and he was firing at me, at the guy, saying that I wasn't bringing in enough business.
Oh, for a month.
Yeah. And just fresh out of law school.
Yeah.
And I found that what he really happened is he found another lawyer who was moving to Toronto who was, you know, more experienced, and he brought him in, and I was gone. The lawyers that I had articles for, like, said that, Paul, they can't do that to you, and we sued him for, like, wrongful dismissal and settled shortly after for no money, really, but enough for, you know, go out for a nice dinner, and they paid all my legal fees. But I learned a very valuable lesson very early in my career as a young lawyer, and that is how traumatic a lawsuit can be. Because when we filed the papers on my behalf for the claim, his response was full of lies and innuendos, and I was like, anytime there was any paperwork, I'd go berserk. So we just settled it, and it just taught me that as difficult it is for people when you're involved in a lawsuit, you want to try and settle at all costs. It just, you know, the worst cases, of course, I'm not involved, was never involved, was family law. But in divorces, you know, the husband or wife will file a petition and the other one will respond with all kinds of things. And all of a sudden, what might have been not such a bad divorce becomes fire because of the lawyers and the things that necessary. So whenever it's possible, I tell people to try to take a deep breath if there's a way to resolve it. And then the other thing, you know, if you've ever been in a courtroom, and not that I was a trial lawyer, when you go into court, you could be telling the absolute truth, but you're nervous, you're shaking.
Oh, yeah.
The judge and jury only see what they see.
Right.
The other person could be lying through their teeth, but they're the most convincing liar.
Right.
They only see what's presented. So it's no matter how good the facts are, you really want to try whenever humanly possible. And it's difficult because people get so emotional.
Right.
So I learned a valuable lesson about, you know, law in the courts.
And that was really early on. I mean, talk about, that was your first gig and you were already practicing law.
So how old were you at the time? 22,
23? 24, 25 maybe, I guess. Okay. So then I didn't have a job.
Right.
Spoke to a guy who my sister was friends with, who was a lawyer doing music work. And he didn't need anybody, but he told me, it was like at a house, this thing, and it was him and another lawyer there. So, Paul, I really don't need you. I can't pay you or anything. But, you know, there's a basement downstairs. There's a desk. If you want to clean it up, you know, you can have a desk and I'll pay you like $50 or $100 a week or something. You know, just a normal thing to, you can do some things. So I said, okay. You know, another example about life lessons about taking shots of anything. I don't know, not more than 4, 5, 6 months later, the other lawyer left. Instead of hiring someone else, he said, Paul, come on upstairs. You got a real office. And now I had a real job with a lawyer in the music industry. So that's...
That was just how you got introduced.
Yeah.
And it's funny how you just waited it out, too. And that's how you got this open opportunity.
Yeah. And in Toronto at that time, now there's many, of course, but there were only about 3 lawyers who were doing any amount of real music industry work. So I was lucky and went from there.
Did the drums come back in your life during this time? Because I know you spoke about it when you were,
no,
you were young. No,
no.
Okay.
Have they ever come back?
No, I realized when I was young and playing drums in bands, I knew a few other drummers who were incredible, but they literally lived and breathed. That was their life. I think they only slept 1 hour a day. And I realized I loved playing drums. I loved being in bands. I loved music. I didn't have the dedication to make it my whole life.
Got it.
There were other things in life besides that. And so I kept my love for music, but not performing. I did have some friends.
Yeah.
That's true.
Who've
That's
gone
true.
On to do some pretty incredible careers in the world of music.
You could live vicariously through them. And
you
could be associated to the music.
Yeah.
You enjoyed being a lawyer. You enjoyed working, right? You enjoyed your job, obviously, at this time, right? After college. And
I didn't practice law very long, only for a few years. And I enjoyed it. What I didn't enjoy was the business of being a lawyer. And what I mean by that is I enjoyed the work, I enjoyed the clients, but you'll go out of business if you're not being paid and paying the bills.
Yeah, the business of the business.
Yeah, and I wasn't good at chasing down people for money and getting retainers, and you have to do that.
Right.
And there's a lot of deadbeats in that business, too. And literally, I was working with a partner going through a list of receivables one night, and all these deadbeats, oh, this one owes us that money, and this one, how are we going to collect that? Maybe there's something else. And there had been a job available at CBS Records, Sony Music. Mm-hmm. The business affairs person left, and they were looking for someone. I knew about it for many months, but I had no interest in going to work. I was this young kid out of college. Like, I was like fighting for the rights of young artists. I like to go to work for CBS Records.
Like the big corporation.
Exactly. The big like corporation. That's not for me. I'm not. Yeah. They're the enemy.
I'm the indie. I'm the indie.
Yeah.
So what changed your mind?
Well, going through the receivables, I went, okay, you know what? I'm going to call the president of CBS, who I knew very well because he represented people on the label. And I went in for the meeting and I went, guys, sounds great. And if it doesn't work out, I could. He offered me the job on the spot. I was kind of lucky because they had, a few months ago, by they had interviewed, there were very few candidates in Canada who had any kind of expertise in the area. So when I came in, they were almost desperate for someone. They were prepared to bring someone up from the States for the role. So they offered me the job. And the guy who left, who I knew, I called him. I said, Rick, Bernie offered me the job. But and he said, oh, Paul, it's a great job, because he had gone on to some other thing. And so I took the job, and there I was, vice president of business affairs for CBS Records.
It's a major corporation.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was? How long were you there? What was your?
I was there for 5 years.
Okay.
And the best thing that happened to me there played a major part of my life. I was very lucky when they signed a young girl who didn't speak English. She was 16, 17 years old, named Celine Dion. Lucky because I met her then, and as you know, we can talk about it later, I eventually went to work full-time with her and her husband, Renee. But I met them by being the lawyer who did the contract.
And they first signed her on, so she was, how old do you say at that time?
She was, I think, 16, almost 17. And in fact, I met Renee, her husband. First time I met them, she was in Paris recording a French album.
Okay.
And I happened to be in Paris on some other reasons, and I met Celine and Renee in Paris, coincidentally, for the first time. And then we signed the contract, and then I became very, very good friends with her and her husband over the years, even though I moved shortly after here.
So if you're at CBS for 5 years,
yeah,
and then you came stateside?
I did.
Where did you land?
A man named Miles Copeland hired me. He and his partner, Jay Boberg, had a company called IRS Records. Miles, of course, managed his brother's band, The Police. His brother was Stuart Copeland. At this point, The Police had disbanded, and Miles was still managing Sting at the time. And he had a record label, IRS Records, with such groups as REM on it, and a lot of great British bands, and a great time to be. But he brought me, and they sponsored me for my visa.
I was going to say, because that's a big deal to bring someone in from another country. Right?
Well, particularly because there was no shortage of young law students who have music industry experience here in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm not taking anything away from my talents, but I've been
Say you're really good at
But I'm so lucky about so many things. And the luck plays so much of a role in so many people's lives. Yes, they like me, but they could have hired someone here. And I'm lucky because they hired me, but they still, I don't know if you have to, now they had to go through the process of advertising in the position.
Yes, because it legally
they actually interviewed people. I was already working there, and I felt bad a little. These people were coming in for interviews for the job that they weren't going to get.
Right.
And they were able to get me my visa and justify it because they did have an operation in Canada, and because of my expertise in Canada. Right. That's what got me the job over there.
Okay. Well, you were the best candidate for that position.
Yeah.
There you go.
But
thank you. I'm helping your alter ego here. Yeah. They
but
wants
lucky
to speak
that
up.
They brought me in. Yeah. And I loved working there.
Wow. And that was a big move for you then. And I mean, look at some of the artists
you
got to work with.
It was a big move because I didn't really know anybody in LA. In fact, I remember the first night I got here, I got to my apartment. And the power hammer turned on, and it was night, and there was like no lights. I remember crying, thinking, what am I doing? Why am I here?
Helping your friends behind
No,
you.
What am I doing? But I also thought, it was one of the situations where I knew if I stayed in Canada, very likely I could have been the president of CBS Records if I stayed there. I could have been, you know, the old saying, a big fish in a small pond.
Right.
But I would rather be a small fish in a big pond, you know, like other parts of the world. Yep. I wanted to be in America. I wanted to do more with my life than just what I could do in Canada. So I thought, if things don't work out, I can always come back to Canada and do what I was doing.
So moving from CBS to IRS,
Right.
What was the difference? I mean, obviously, coming to the States, but in terms of the caliber of artists you worked with, and you say it was a lot of great British bands, did you find it, was there a big difference from moving one to the other? Working in the States, did you find there was a big change in terms of how things were done?
Yeah, because in Canada, again, it was CBS Records, but I was dealing with just local Canadian artists.
Mm-hmm.
It was frustrating, and even the president of the company in Canada, a guy named Bernie DeMatteo, was from New York, and he came up from International to run the Canadian operation. And he was frustrated. He became fiercely, proudly Canadian. He was frustrated by the incredible success Canadian artists were having in Canada, who were unknown in the States.
Right.
And so he actually said, I'm not going to sign any anymore. He felt so bad for the artists that if he signed them, they weren't going to get a good shot internationally. He'd rather see them signed to the American company directly. It's interesting. Till this day, Celine Dion is probably the only Canadian artist on the planet Earth who, to this day, remains signed to Sony Canada. The big, big names that are out in the world who are Canadian were not signed to the Canadian record companies. And I'm proudly Canadian-American. No one's more proud of Canada than me. I go back a few times a year. Everyone who knows me knows that. And yet it's disappointing and frustrating for Canadian artists.
Right.
There are a number of big acts there who just can't cross over.
Well, that's the thing about the United States, right? And for any other country or any artist, whether it be a film or any industry,
yeah,
breaking into the U.S. is a big deal, right?
Because yeah, look, there are artists from England, big artists in England.
Don't make it here.
Yeah.
Let alone
artists from other country where they're not in the same language.
And I would imagine if you working with these artists too, it's like, I mean, first of all, they have to have the competitive edge, right? And there's also other expectations, I would imagine, because when you make it here and then you have an album and you do it or anything in your profession, what's next?
Yeah.
And then what's next and what's next? And it's that pressure of constantly getting better and delivering the results, right, as well.
Yeah, I know, absolutely.
But I would have thought also, being in America, the delivery and everything else is done here must be totally different to how it was done in Canada. You are on an international stage here.
Right.
And, you know, the artists you're talking about, as you say, they're British artists, The Police or Sting or whoever else it might be, REM, colossal bands with a huge following. Mm-hmm. So it must have been a bit of an eye-opener coming here from Canada.
No question. And then the other thing that was so different is the IRS records offices at the time were on Universal, the movie studio lot. And I got to be friendly with people at Universal Pictures. One day, Bert Berman, the head of the music department for Universal Pictures, his business affairs guy left and he said, Paul, why don't you come work for me? I don't know anything about the film and TV business. I know music, but from a record company point of view. And he said, Paul, don't worry about it. And again,
Paul, you have a lucky charm in your back pocket.
Yeah, no, because
we rub ourselves up against him.
He hired me over other people who I know personally who were far more qualified because they were doing the same job at some of the other studios in town. That's my entry at Universal. But again, you know, being in Los Angeles and working for a record company, that's the thing. You've got film and TV and commercial. There's so many other things going on that people you can be exposed to.
How did your role change when you went to Universal? Was you becoming a greater portfolio of artists or?
Well, yeah. I mean, whereas IRS was pretty much rock and roll,
right.
That when you're making movies,
you
could be dealing with composers or soundtracks and artists who are doing opera, classical, country and western, rap, hip, every style. And it was, I just loved being.
You could choose almost. You got exposed. And were you looking for that? For that more exposure outside of just the music?
Wasn't looking for it. It just presented itself.
Here we go again with the Lucky Charm.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
There's an interesting story about Celine and my first job there. My first week working at Universal Pictures, I had made plans already to go up to Canada to see the music awards up there. It's called the Juno Awards. That's like the Brit Awards or the Grammys.
Okay.
But I just started a new job, and my boss, Bert, said, well, Paul, it's okay, you can go up there. Bert had told me on my first week of the job, the two most important people you need to know in this job are a guy named Mike Gorfain and Sam Schwartz. They have a music agency here called Gorfain Schwartz Agency, and they represent the John Williams and the James Newton Hardware. You know, most of the
legend.
Biggest composers on the planet Earth. So you got to get to know them, because I'm going to be negotiating contracts for those composers for films. So they happened to be, coincidentally, in Vancouver, where the Junos were that year. And that's where I first met them. Celine sang at the Junos that year, but she was really still unknown in the States. And they came up to me and said, "Paul, do you know this girl? She's incredible." I went, "Yeah, I just spent the whole day with her." I introduced them, and they said, "We have an idea. Steven Spielberg is doing a new movie called American Tail, Five Will Goes West." It was a sequel to American Tail. It was an animated thing.
Remember that,
Mouse?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
And the first movie had a huge hit by Linda Ronstadt and James Ingram called Somewhere Out There. And they said, "We would love Celine to consider doing the song." So I come back to work, and I'm like, I'm just a week on the job. And now all of a sudden, I'm talking to my boss about Celine Dion doing a Steven Spielberg movie. It's like, this is crazy. I'm pinching myself. Linda Ronstadt, this is probably a story that's never been told. Linda Ronstadt turned down the song, didn't love the song, so they were looking for someone else. So Celine recorded the song. Somehow Linda Ronstadt got a hold of it and heard the song.
Uh-oh.
She went, "Oh, I want to do it." And Steven Spielberg rightfully said, "Well, who is Celine Dion?" "It's Linda Ronstadt. She already gave us one hit. We're going to go." And I remember Sam and Mike said, "Paul, don't worry. James Horner was working on, I think it was called Hook or something, a Dustin Hoffman movie."
Yeah, about Peter Pan.
Yeah. James Horner was doing the score for that.
Okay.
"We're going to go down and speak to James. When James speaks to Spielberg, when it comes to music, he'll listen to James because we want Celine."
Right.
But he didn't listen because it was Linda Ronstadt. I didn't tell Renee right away. I knew he'd be devastated. Remember, I'm not working for him anyway. My boss, Bert, and I, we actually flew to Montreal to break the news to Renee Perth, because there had already been stories in the Montreal papers. I actually have
It was already published at
the I have copies of the newspaper still at home, The Montreal Gazette. Celine Dion starring a new Steven Spielberg movie. It's like big success. Nobody knows her in the States. Okay. And I know it sounds crazy. It's one of the few times I saw Renee kind of get teary-eyed and so emotional. It was like devastating. And he didn't know how to tell Celine the news. It wasn't just that it was a Steven Spielberg movie and a great song with James Horner. She loved the song. It was called Dreams to Dream. The first song she ever recorded in French was a song her mother wrote about dreams. So she really related to the song.
It was very personal.
Very personal. Renee never told her. And the record company, Sony, was kind of pissed off. And that's when they decided she got presented with the opportunity to do Beauty and the Beast with Peeble Bryson. So Renee kind of finally went slim, and they said, "I have good news and bad news. You're not doing this, but you're going to..." And she was devastated, like...
Because she was more attached to the personal story, right?
Yeah.
Her mom. Yes.
That's what happened. But as karma works in life, Beauty and the Beast really launched Celine in America in many ways. And Dreams to Dream by Linda Ronstadt came out and never saw... I mean, it was released, but it never was a hit.
Right. Sorry,
doors.
So it was meant to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, in hearing your stories of, first of all, going back to the luck, like you were in the right position. You were being pulled into. But again, getting pulled, it's like you were taking leaps as well, right? You were doing...
Well, I've been lucky. I never pressed my luck like Renee, Celine's husband, and became a gambler in Vegas. I'm not a gambler. Yeah.
You were smart. You were smart with your luck.
So tell us about, because you spent a long time with Celine.
Yeah.
17 years.
At the label, and then I moved down here. And the reason I got so close to them was, when I moved here, she came to record her first English album here, after having done a French album for Sony. And she recorded at David Foster Studio in Malibu. Now remember, they knew nobody. She didn't even speak English, barely. And they had no friends here. So they said, "Paul, come hang out studio, have lunch, have dinner." And then over the years, while I was, you know, working at IRS and working at Universal and then Fox, they would always come down to do a TV show, an award show, a recording session, a photo session, a video shoot. And they'd always call me. And we became good friends. And, you know, sometimes we would talk about it seriously, sometimes jokingly, "But Paul, one day you're going to work for us. One day you're going to work for us." and eventually it did happen. And I went to work for them full time for a long period of time. Yeah.
What you were doing before, just to kind of contextualize your work, you were mostly negotiating deals on behalf of the...
Composers.
Composers. Okay.
For films, and then at Fox, the same thing, when I went to Fox after Universal. which I'll tell you about another interesting life lesson to pass on to people. But I went to Fox at the same job and was negotiating the composer agreements for all the films and for TV and overseeing the licensing. I had a staff of people there who were doing licensing music for films and also composing new music, not just songwriters besides composers, and doing soundtrack deals, which in those days, of course, were, it's almost disappeared now, soundtrack albums. In those days, people bought even just score albums from movies, people would buy them.
Yes.
So that was a big part of the business.
And I think a lot of people forget that from a content perspective, the rights are very tricky when it comes to music, I think. Yeah. And the music makes a lot of the content. It's very emotive, so it brings it to life.
It is. Actually, think about it. So it's Guardians of the Galaxy, the first one they did, they had the most amazing soundtrack. Right. It was all from the 70s and 80s. And all of a sudden, you download the soundtrack, some really, really, really great songs on that.
And it brings the characters.
And one of the problems, as you both know very well from your own experiences, a composer can't write the music till the movie's done. Yeah. He has to see the movie.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to license music, there's no budget left. We spent all the money.
There you go. You're right, Paul.
And so in those days, getting money in advance, like from a record company for a soundtrack, was really helped get the music done. But licensing songs, it all costs money. But the budgets evaporate by the time they get to the music department.
It's a shame because, as you say, a film, the score, the soundtrack is what makes the film.
Oh, it does.
We've discussed this before, but occasionally when I'm flying over here, I'm watching a film and I have the headphones in and I start to fall asleep. You realise how little dialogue there is in a film and how much of a film is actually music, be it a score or a soundtrack. It's quite surprising, actually.
Well, and the musical score is part of the story. It's that one part in the film or whatever it is, series, that it's supposed to elongate, like it takes you through, it's a raft. It takes you through this emotions, and it's almost a continuation, but it's an emotional story, right? And so it's a pivotal time in the film, actually.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed my years at Universal and Fox, working in film and TV music.
So
now you're with. Now you're with. Can we just start talking about Celine?
Yeah. Sorry, I just want to go back to Celine, if you don't mind, just a second. So you from Universal, you went to work for Celine Renee?
No, from Universal, I went to work for Fox. And here's the other little life lesson.
Yeah.
I loved my job at Universal, and I loved my boss. I'd mentioned the guy who hired me was a guy named Bert Berman. He went and left to go to another studio. And then my best friend at the studio who worked alongside me, Harry Garfield, became the head of the music department, and he was my boss. Like, this was so great. But then the same job came open at Fox. It was the exact same job, same title.
Right.
But the salary was $50,000 more.
Wow.
And this is like 25 years ago or something. I mean, $50,000 now would be a lot, but then it was really
a lot of money, Paul.
I would have stayed at Universal, but they couldn't.
Because you had an offer, you show them like
so
you had an offer you couldn't refuse.
Right. So I left, and here's another story I probably never told outside of close friends, but it's fine. It's worth repeating because it's a good lesson for people. I went to Fox, and I loved the people there. I loved the job, and I couldn't have been happier. But things sort of changed once I was there, and I wasn't happy with some of the people that I was working with. It was a different setup there. Nothing to do with my dear friends, Robert Kraft or Matt Walden, who are the people I primarily work for.
But that's the disclaimer. Attention, everybody.
But there were other people there. And there were days of Harry at Universal called me up and said, Paul, the guy I hired is not working out. I'd love you to come back, but I still can't pay you any more money. I would have said, I'll be there tomorrow, Harry. And so the lesson is, when you're leaving a job, you know the players, you know the people, you've been there, you know what it's like, the good and the bad and the ugly.
Yes.
Wherever you're going, though, how green it seems and beautiful and right, if you're going, you don't know until you're there on a day-to-day basis working with people. So you really have to think long and hard, is it worth it if I'm going, just because I'm getting more money, is that really going to make me happier? And so I always tell people that story,
really
just
think it through, huh?
Think it through when you're thinking.
It is true, and it's so easy to get drawn by the money, but it's the
people. Yeah.
And as you get older, at least I'm feeling it now, it's the people that I really want to be around with than the money, so to speak.
Something I've learned over the years is, yes, be successful,
be the best that you can be, but success will bring the rewards. But if you are constantly looking, I'm saying you were for a second, but some people constantly chase money, you're never happy because you never got enough.
Well, you're constantly chasing.
Yeah, and that's what happens. So to have done what you know, yeah. Kind of highlights it, and to have gone back to where you were happy at Universal must have been a relief, actually. So I'd have thought to have gone back.
But then I got rescued from Fox by Renee and Celine.
Oh, so you never went back?
The timing was, I was there. We were, doing the Titanic movie. I did James Horner's
film.
So that was going to be my question. How did that come about?
Tiny film.
So, I did James Horner's contract. I was having breakfast with Renee. They were in L.A., and he was keeping me waiting for a long time, which was, first of all, I cannot say enough nice things about Renee and Celine. There are no finer people on the planet. They treated me, and they treated everybody around them so well, with kindness and love. And really, I have only the most wonderful memories of working with them. They were doing Titanic, and while I'm sitting there, he was having breakfast. He was late. He apologized, and he told me why, thing he was dealing with. And I said to him sort of jokingly, "Oh, Renee, if I was working for you, see, you wouldn't have to deal with those things. I'd be taking care of that." Mm-hmm. And he went, "You're right, Paul. That's it. Come work with me." And he literally that day told me to come work with him. I gave my notice to Fox, and they were very happy because I'm going to work with Celine Dion. Good for you, Paul.
That's important to them.
And so now I'm sitting in my trailer on the lot at Fox. I've given my notice. Mike Gorfang from Gorfang Schwartz called me, and he says, "Paul, listen, James has now finished the score for the movie. And now that he's finished it, it cries out for a theme. There's a song that just keeps recurring. And he thought there should be a song. So he called his lyricist, Will Jennings. They wrote a song. Your bosses don't know about it. James Cameron doesn't know about it. John Landau, the producer doesn't know about it. Because when that movie was being made, James Cameron, the director, and John Landau, the producer, were adamant about it being sort of a real-life historical drama where the only music in the film would be original score. The orchestra was playing as the ship was going down.
Yes.
But no Mariah Carey, Whitney Houston, Celine Dion, big ending songs or anything like that.
Right.
And if you think back, there were no toys at McDonald's or Burger King.
There wasn't a massive licensing.
No.
Yeah.
So, but we like to play the song for Celine. So I called Renee. They happened to be in Vegas. This is long, long before her residency in Vegas, but they used to love to go to Vegas anyway, and she performed there, just, the odd concert. Flew to Vegas with Mike Gorfang, James Horner, mm-hmm. sat at the piano and played Titanic and tried to sing the song. He really can't sing. It's true that Celine really didn't like the song that much, couldn't really relate to it. And Renee had the idea right then and there to say, well, why don't we have Celine demo the song? If James Cameron has never heard the song, let him hear it with Celine, not just some demo singer. And they go, "We didn't come here to insult Celine. She was already a big star." And ask her to do a demo. Renee goes, "No, but that's how it should be done." And it's true that that's what she did. And the story didn't end then. She did the song and obviously played it for James Cameron. He still wasn't so sure, and Sony wasn't sure. And I remember sitting in a screening room at Paramount Pictures screening room in New York on Broadway with Renee and Celine, with James Cameron, John Landau, some of the executives from Sony Music. There was one person there, a woman who was a survivor from the ship.
Oh.
Yeah, in attendance. And I remember sitting behind Renee and Celine, and they were like sobbing with tissues. The next day we had a meeting at Sony, and no matter what you read or hear, Sony was not really convinced that she should do this picture. The version we saw was probably about 30 minutes longer than the final long version. Anybody who remembers when that movie was made, and you would, if you read The Hollywood Reporter, Variety, or Into the Trades, all you were hearing about was the fighting on the set in Mexico.
Yeah.
And this is a real life
travesty of the budget.
This is a real life disaster movie. They can never make their money back, let alone show profit. Nobody wanted to go near the picture.
Yeah.
So why would you want to attach your star artist to the picture? But Renee and Celine were just so moved by the love story. It really moved them. I remember like yesterday, Renee stood up at the meeting and said, no true words. He said, "I'm a gambler and I'm gambling on this one." Cameron was so insistent about not being part of the movie. When you're at the movie theater watching the movie, mm-hmm. you don't hear Celine's voice until the movie's completely ended, when the credits start to roll. Usually the songs start near the end, but no, it was like the movie ends, now you can play the song.
But that was got to be one of the most iconic soundtrack songs.
Oh.
Well, interesting you say soundtrack, because James Horner put a score album out of just score but including the My Heart Will Go On, 25, maybe 30 million copies worldwide, which is beyond crazy. And Celine's album with that song, 30 million. So James Horner's one song is on about 60 million albums, and you can probably count the number of artists who have sold 60 million albums in their entire career.
Exactly.
But it just shows you the power, too, of what film does with a song. I mean, we were interviewing Terry Nunn, right? Yes. When she talked about Take My Breath Away.
Yeah. Top Gun.
Right? On Top Gun. I mean, these movies do really catapult, right?
And that movie came out, as you might remember, on Christmas.
Oh, I know. At the time it was.
Still nobody knew what to expect. And on New Year's Day, I remember it. New Year's Day, John Delp, the executive at Sony, who was in charge of Celine, called me and said, Paul, I'm trying to find Renee. Do you know where I can find Renee? The song is exploding. They were kind of caught off guard in a way. They didn't expect it to be like that. Yeah. And it was like, I remember number one on like Spanish charts where everything was in Spanish. It was everywhere. And by the time it actually was released by Sony as a single, it was probably only number one for 1 or 2 weeks because it was already.
But in the UK,
it was at number one for absolutely ages, and weeks.
That's the other thing, the global effect. Sometimes it's just a little bump here, but around the world, and as you're talking about time.
I travel out, and I sometimes say, oh, I worked with Lena on people maybe in China or somewhere. Right. And if you say, oh, Titanic, they know.
Yes, I know.
Everybody knows that song. Personal. Some people might not recognize the name Celine Dion. Some few people, but some.
Everyone knows that song.
They know the song.
Yeah.
When she's on tour, when she was and we were on tour, it would always be the last song of the show. And when we would do like runners, when we'd be leaving the stadium, she would come off stage. The car is like right there in the building and gone. And so I know that for my ride, I better be there. And everyone always said, I never want to hear two words come out of Celine's mouth. Where's Paul?
Yeah.
Not that she's,
she's already in the car.
Yeah, I know, but I don't, but it happened one time in Paris. When we entered the arena, we all got off inside a certain gate, and then, show's getting, I go there, song's on, there's nobody, no cars. They had changed the departure gate, but no one told me.
Oh, no. So you got stuck.
Well, not for long.
You've had the whatever you want to call it, luck or, benefit and hard work of working alongside these great people. I mean, legends. What are some of the things you learned from working close to somebody who's just artistically talented beyond, worldly talented? What are some things that you learned, whether it be personal or business practice or, that you could share from, your years in the industry?
Artists are human beings,
yeah,
and they have different temperaments. And some, like Celine, are incredibly gracious and wonderful. And sadly, there are some who they just feel like they are better than everyone else or something. And they're not kind. They're not nice to people. Some of them like that, who they're like that at the height of their career. And they get very humbled. Because no one's career lasts at that level forever.
Right.
And eventually they come down to earth. Actually, as they get older, they get a little wiser and realize, geez, I was an asshole. But they're different temperaments and different people for the most part. I like to think, most people are pretty good. But, the bigger the artist, the more pampered they are, whether it's a musician or an actor, people don't know, are afraid to tell them no or to give their honest opinion. They're walking on eggshells.
They constantly feel like they have to be pleased, or they
yeah, and they're concerned about their own jobs, so they don't want to offend the artist in some way and think, I don't want to risk my cushy job.
Right. Well, and your job is to protect rights, right? And negotiate. So I would imagine that you probably have seen the reverse, where people have taken advantage of an artist or didn't necessarily know what worth they had, right, by lending their art.
Yeah.
Okay. With Celine, so your role was purely as a lawyer, or did you expand that role while you were with them?
Often, until this day, people say, Paul was Celine Dion's attorney. I was never her attorney. She always has had and has an attorney, an outside attorney who's in private practice. I was part of the management team with Renee, together with a great guy named Dave Platel, who's been involved with her for many years, and was part of the management team. Of course, because my background the emphasis was more on the business-related parts of her career. But because it was a small operation and she was, you know, I was there for the best years of her career, really. I mean, not that there's still not, hopefully, best years coming ahead. But, you know, she's dealing with her health issues. So there was so much going on. So I would do whatever it took. And if Renee said, can you get me a cup of coffee? I'd get a cup of coffee. I'm not, like, too proud to say, no, that's not for me. Sure. You just pitch in and do whatever it takes at any given time. And there's always unforeseen things come up. And, for example, when we were on the road, there's no need for a lawyer to be on tour. I never, any time that I was out on tour with them, felt like, geez, what am I doing here? I've got nothing to do. Something seemed to always come up that we'd have meetings about, not necessarily legal matters, but business matters.
Business
means. What are just other things that, you know, it was good to have another body. You know,
a business.
You know, Renee and Celine trusted me blindly.
That's it. It's that, trust. Clearly, and that's where I was going to get.
There are things they trust me with that just.
With your working with the people that you were working with, Celine,
yeah.
you have to have that trust there, because obviously the conversations you're having, those are intimately private, and how easy for things to get leaked out. That element has got to be crucial.
Yeah, there's no question about that.
And leveraging your expertise, because at this time you've been in the industry, right? You know your stuff, and so it's also being tapping into someone that's, you're negotiating. I'm sure you were involved in global deals too, as well.
Right. So coming away from Celine, so you were with her for the period of time you were, but then what came next?
So when Renee got ill, they were sort of reevaluating the organization and everything, the financial guy, everything. They just were looking at numbers. They said they really didn't want to afford the luxury of keeping me on the payroll anymore. It was not my decision to leave.
Sure.
But I could not have left on better terms. Renee called me up, you know, gave me a nice severance package, and I could not have left on better terms. In fact, when he died less than a year later, I was one of the people Celine called and asked to speak at his service.
Oh, that's nice.
Because she knew I was not just working for him, I was a friend. Because I was a friend before I went to work for him. He was my friend. It was one of the most difficult things I've had to do, but I did it. Before the service, they wanted all of us to practice our speech, and they had a teleprompter. I've never used a teleprompter in my life. And I didn't want to, because I thought for me it would be distracting. So I knew what I wanted to say. And
you're speaking from the heart.
Yeah. So I didn't use the teleprompter.
Good.
And I've continued to have a good relationship with Celine and her entire team, and have been actually involved with some things over the last few years, and continue to, you know, be in discussions with them about certain projects. So, and people, even though I've been gone working with her 7-8 years maybe, people will still call me about Celine-related matters. Were you there in Paris?
Yeah. Thinking
that I would have been there. I just, you know, no, I don't work with her. It wasn't no reason for me to be there. When I left, I decided, well, what am I going to do now? I thought I would become a manager of talent. Mm-hmm. And I considered some talent, and then I decided I just didn't have it in me. I know how much time and effort and money is involved in developing a brand new artist to the point where they make money. And so as a manager, traditionally working on a percentage basis only, I knew that if I'm developing a new artist, I'm not making any money for 2 or 3 years at best. And that's if everything goes right and we really get lucky. Now, that being said, I would never discourage, and people know me, on the contrary, I encourage anybody to pursue their dreams and have their success. I just don't want to invest my life right at this point in my life in that. So I just decided to take advantage of, you know, the many contacts I've had and people I've got to know, and work on other projects. So I do a lot of things for people outside of America who maybe want to do some things here, but they don't have the relationships or contacts I have. So they will hire me to do things. There's a company in Japan involved in a lot of the ticketing system for sporting and concert events in Japan, but they have this new technology. They wanted to meet with the people here, like a Ticketmaster, Access, and other companies in the States. I've worked with an artist in Korea. There's a wonderful company in Salzburg, Austria, Moon Lake Entertainment, a man named Hannes Shaw, who does a lot of documentaries, sports, music, different categories. And a few years ago, he was doing a documentary about, it sounds crazy, but just about the one song, Silent Night, the Christmas song, which was written by people in Salzburg 200 years ago. So they did a recreation dramatic documentary kind of thing, basically hired me to help get some artists, you know, prominent artists to the song. And I guess the biggest artist I was able to get for them was one. It was Kelly Clarkson, who did an incredible version with the Vienna Boys Choir and Vienna Philharmonic.
I don't think I remember that, actually.
So, yeah, and it's been televised like 180 countries around the world. And one interesting story that definitely no one knows, but no big secret.
You heard it
first? Yes, exclusive.
I literally approached Justin Bieber's management and Andrea Bocelli's. Of course, Andrea Bocelli, I have a long relationship because of Celine. And I could actually show you in writing emails where Justin Bieber and Andrea Bocelli agreed to do the duet of Silent Night together.
Really?
And it only didn't happen because of scheduling.
No.
Yeah.
That's a shame.
Yeah. But
needs to be put back on the calendar.
Yeah, well, Hannah's talking about that, actually. But yeah, it never happened. But now we're working on a new project. It's, I think, the 60th or 75th anniversary of Sound of Music's coming up next year.
60th,
yeah. And of course, a lot of it was filmed in Salzburg. I was interviewed some of the Von Trapp family who were living in Vermont. I interviewed some of the living cast members from the show. Filmed a lot of it in the original places in Salzburg. And he's had Walter Afanasieff, a incredibly successful producer, to produce songs. We've had like Babyface and Pentatonix and a bunch of other artists do some of the classic songs, still in developing.
Do you still get a kick out of what you do?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, people say, Paul, you're 72 years old, aren't you?
You don't look 72 years old.
Thank you.
I'd probably look more like 72 years old than you do.
But aren't you thinking about retirement? I go,
no, I don't think you can.
I don't even think about it. I have as much energy or more than ever, and
keep doing
and still get very excited by working on exciting projects.
Keep doing that. You know, Paul, it's funny. People were giving you opportunities, and especially with the new artists that you're working, and I feel like you're now offering and helping other people come in, and so you're like the entry point, and you're sharing that and providing, helping other people gain their opportunities.
So last weekend, I went to a concert here in L.A. On the grounds of SoFi Stadium at Hollywood Park called Hard Summer.
Yeah.
And I'm not embarrassed to say I didn't know the names of any of the artists on the show, although my daughters did, except for one, and the one I went to see because it was an artist from Toronto named Nelly Furtado, and her musical director, Dean Jarvis, is a good friend. He says, Paul, we're doing this thing. Why don't you come over? And I went over. It was a really, really young crowd, like young, you know, teenagers and very young, mostly house music, electronic music and stuff. I was watching at one point in LA, and these two girls came up to me and said, how old are you?
Oh, no.
And I went, 72. And they went, no way. Show us your driver's license. Why would I lie? I'm not going to, And they said, how old are you guys, 22? No, we're 26. We came down from Oregon for the thing. I said, oh, okay, well, that's nice. I said, I have daughters that are like 21-year-old twins, and they wanted to come. They couldn't come this weekend. And they went, oh, God bless you. You know, it's wonderful. And I walked away, and then they came over to me, and they handed me a little, like a tiny, it turned out to be like a glass turtle or something. Yeah. See, I thought it was an edible. It was another story. I don't do drugs, which is another crazy story. But I thought that's what it was.
No, I have to be no advice.
But it was, but it was glass. It wasn't. So we just want to give you this gift for, you know, God bless you and your family. Okay, and then I left the area because I didn't want to be seen talking to these two scantily clothed young girls.
Yeah. Giving you something.
Okay, I'm getting out of here.
Oh, that's funny.
But I actually had a great time there.
I'll see, because you're still young at heart, Paul.
And I watched some of the other music, and I had a great time.
That's good.
I walked miles that day.
Yeah.
The grounds, it's so big, that SoFi Stadium. Outside, they had five stages. I don't keep track of my steps, but that day I thought, I'm going to look at my phone. And I did 22,529 steps last Saturday night, which is crazy.
That's a lot.
Yeah,
it's about 10 miles.
Yeah.
You did the math.
It's insane, but everything was so far apart.
Right.
Some people get to a certain stage in their life and then can't do this anymore. But when you've got a passion for something, it really shows.
Mm-hmm.
And that passion never dies. If you enjoy what you do, what's the expression? If you enjoy what you do, you never work a day in your life.
Right. Well, the other exciting project I'm working on now is a Broadway musical.
Yes. Tell us about Obsessed.
So I've been friends with Diane Warren, the 14 or 15 time nominated for an Oscar songwriter for films, written so many incredible hit songs for so many artists. She wrote some of Celine's biggest hits. Another friend of mine was in town a few years ago. We were having lunch. Diane was talking about someone who had written a Broadway show. My friend Arit, is her name, said, well, what happened was, well, you know, takes a lot of time and money. And Arit said, well, send it to me. And she read it, loved it, and said, I'm going to do this. Put her money where her mouth is. She mounted an incredible presentation. It wasn't just a reading in the sense of a traditional reading of a play. A Tony Award-winning choreographer, director, cast, who are people who are on Broadway, other Broadway shows, and live music. He worked with the writer on the story, and it became a great story as well as great music, and was incredible. It was really... I introduced her to Michael Cole, who's an impresario, producer of music, Broadway. They're now partners. They're working with Diane and with Joe DiPietro, the book writer, and in development now for what will, at some point in the next year or two.
Yeah, I was going to ask
it'll,
you.
It takes time, but it'll okay. get done. There will be a...
Yeah.
Of course, Diane Warren is not a household name that the public knows, but they know many of her songs that have just been huge.
Well, that must be amazing to work with.
And her story, it's a great story. Okay. Where it's written.
Yeah, but that's actually amazing to work on as well for you now.
Yeah.
It's different. You're dabbling a whole bunch of different things, right. Which is cool.
And this is what I enjoy, yeah.
Okay, so look, we're at a point in the show where we would ask our guests to pick a card from the deck that's in front of you, any card, and ask the question if you would answer it, and then Norma and I will answer it as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
And quite deep.
And we asked it, take a beat, but read it out loud so we know what the question is. Any card, too. Any card. Pick a good one.
Malcolm has to do this and he got the wrong answer.
Okay. You want me to read it now?
Yes, please.
What negative trait do you publicly laugh about, but secretly know you have to fix?
Oh.
What negative trait do you publicly laugh about?
What a negative trait.
I'm supposed to answer first?
You are. Yeah. If you would.
If you... Unless you need a beat, and then you could pass, and then we'll come back to you. Do you need a minute?
No, I mean, a minute, but I mean, okay. Of course, the obvious answer is I have no negative traits, but of course, but I have more than in one. Well, it's certainly not drugs, and it's not alcohol.
Yeah.
I don't know if one would call this a negative trait, but everyone who knows me knows my passion.
Oh, I like how you're spitting it.
Passion and love, I guess more than music, certainly as much as music or more, for food. but not just food, the worst food on the planet, like Randy's Donuts and ice cream and all the worst things possible. I've been working on that.
Okay.
For weight loss, I don't believe there's any great secrets, Ozempic or this fat diet or that diet or anything. I'm actually just lost 20 pounds, and I'm continuing to do it. But it's been rather simple in a way because there's no secret in my mind. Everybody knows if you continue to eat a pint of ice cream every day and donuts and cheeseburgers and french fries and a whole pizza at midnight, you are not going to lose weight and you are going to gain weight.
I'm sorry.
But if you cut out these things, you know, everyone has good sense of eating salads and eating grilled fish and meat and eating what's healthy and what's not, and not denying yourself or starving from having some treats every now and then, but by really cutting back and eating much smarter and exercising, I think it's no secret. Anybody can do that. So I don't know if you call that a trait, a negative trait, but...
You're answering the question. Our guests get to answer the question, or anyone gets to answer the question.
I think with food, it's like everything in life, it's moderation.
Yeah.
It's just finding that balance. Because I mean,
how I was drinking my wine.
Yeah, okay, good. Rich?
I'll let you go next.
Why? Because you need a minute.
Yeah, I need a minute.
You need a minute?
I need a beat.
Okay, you need a beat. Okay, what negative trait? I'm going to read it again. What negative trait do you publicly laugh about, but secretly know you have to fix? I have like two personalities, I feel. There's corporate Norma, right? Who can become very intense and bossy. And then there's like relaxed, fun, loving Norma, right? Which is the one at home. And there's times when I will say, well, did you do this? What about that? What about this?
Hang on a minute.
Hang on a minute. Hang on. Hold. Please hold. And it comes across like holy crap, she's like, she's being really bossy. And it's just because I'm I'm justifying my negative trait. I'm processing things. And so I'm thinking about, okay, if this happens, then these other five things are happening. And so I use those words to give me a minute and a beat, or just to ensure that everything has been thought through. But it comes across like I'm being bossy, or I'm being, and I'm looking at you.
Because she's being bossy.
Yeah, because I'm being bossy. So, yeah, that's my response. Anyway, I'll be quiet now.
Okay.
Rich, now
it's your minute. I'm just going to hold on a minute. Am I going
to release the hold? And
thank you very much.
And it's you.
I think one of my negative traits, which I laugh at, and I know people around me do, is I'm not the most patient of people.
Oh, I've seen that.
To get things done, I like to move quickly.
Even with the finger snapping.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nice and loud.
Yeah, it is. Because I'm used to using them.
I know.
I like to get things done quickly, and sometimes just slow down a little bit. And I am working on slowing down a little bit, but that I would say, I'm sure it's plenty of other people say I've got more negative traits than that, but I probably don't want to air them publicly. Okay. That's probably one of my biggest ones, where I'm just too quick sometimes in terms of how I respond. Take a step back.
And I'll be bold now and say, I tend to be sometimes like a real life Larry David from Curb Your Enthusiasm. I have no tolerance for so many things, and I want to express myself that way, but try to hold back as much as possible, but I don't hold back enough. And my daughters in particular are constantly, Dad, you can't say that. Dad, you can't. Dad, what are you doing?
I get told I've got no filter.
Yeah.
That's what I get.
Well, actually, this is a great segue to the final part of our hour, is you don't have to hold back. You can be Larry, but one thing we'd like to ask or have our guests is if they could share some feedback and kind of talk to our audiences. So now that you've, you know, in telling your story, I know there was that young boy, that young Jewish boy that grew up in Toronto, right? And if he could give advice now. And talk to our audiences, and maybe the things that he's learned, or, you know, things to avoid. Like, what would you share with other people now?
In whether it's a career in music or film or TV or theater or anything at all, any profession, nothing to do with entertainment industry, get out there and not stay home. I always tell people, you know, they say, oh, should I go to this convention or should I go to this expo? Should I go there? And I said, can't guarantee if you go there, you'll meet anybody. It'll be worth your time. But I can guarantee if you stay home, nothing's going to happen. So I encourage people within means, like, you know, even if there's some convention or some conference and, you know, maybe they can't afford to attend, you know what? You can go down to the hotel, right, Hang out in the lobby, cost you nothing at the lobby. You might not, but you might have the opportunity to bump into someone, be surprised, someone you could never possibly ever get through their secretary on the phone to have a conversation with. And it's happened to me, and it's happened, I'm sure, to both of you. Whatever it is you're doing to get out, if you're shy, try to go with friends who aren't, just meet as many people, network. I mean, I think sometimes my friends will joke, oh, Paul, you go to the opening of an envelope, you know. But yeah, it's not so untrue, but that's, I think, been part of how I've been successful, is by getting out there and getting to meet a lot of people and help me get through in some ways to things. So that maybe be some.
That's good advice. It's great advice, actually.
Get out there. And then also, too, when you put yourself out there, you wonder, oh, why isn't anything happening to me? Well, if you're not doing anything different, right? If you're not out there, if you're not visible, then how are people going to know about you if you're not visible? So yeah, I think that's great advice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for being our guest. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to Energist Podcast, where ambition meets achievement. If today's stories energized you, share this episode with someone who needs that spark. Stay connected. Subscribe to our newsletter at nrjmediagroup.com. And follow us on social media for more powerful insights. Until next time, stay inspired, stay bold, and keep striving for greatness.
Energist Podcast is produced and hosted by Norma Garcia and Rich Reed. The incredible talent behind us. We are highly engineered and edited by Rich Evers. Our seriously creative director is none other than David H. Tanaka. Our talented music composer is Steve Devaney. Our devotion to motion graphic designer is Mike Macklin. Our very spirited technical advisor is Tracy Williams. Our amazing marketing manager, Lauren Carter. Our man of many words publicist is Josh Gershman. And introducing our producer's assistant, Blake Mealy. Energist Podcast is brought to you by NRJ Media Group.